About five jurors, then?
Yeah.
Five jurors? You have five now?
Well, what's second?
We're on grand juries on page
35 of the yellow book.
Yeah.
Well, no, we don't think so, because for one thing, now the statute states that 132.010, a grand jury consists of seven persons. But neither the statute nor the Constitution indicates how many it takes to constitute a quorum. There is a provision, of course, as we cite in the Constitution, five must concur to find an indictment. It doesn't say...
In the Constitution?
The Constitution says yes.
Where?
We cite that verbatim at the bottom of page 39, under Section 5, Article 7, amended, part of it relating to grand juries. It says, seven shall be chosen by lot as grand jurors, five of whom must concur to find an indictment. All we're saying is that, okay, if five can concur to find an indictment, five can otherwise transact business to the grand jury, and that you don't need seven there to have a quorum, that you can proceed with five grand jurors. This was raised to us, this question was raised by one of the district attorneys, and they didn't know, and we found out in talking with some of the DAs that it kind of varies. Some of them don't want to go ahead unless they have seven. Some of them do go ahead. Frankly, there's no way for the defendant to know whether six grand jurors heard the testimony or all seven. Or the only thing the statute, the Constitution requires is that five concur in the indictment.
How would it be to have some alternate grand jurors? You know, when they have a long murder trial or something, they have alternate jurors who can step in and take the place of a regular juror. If it's so hard to get seven together.
I suppose you could do it that way. We provide under 63 order that another person be drawn, sworn, take place of a discharged juror, and then under the new sub 3 to allow at least five grand jurors to proceed. I think you could provide for alternate grand jurors. We also have a provision in here.
We're on page 39 of the yellow book.
Right. Got in over and gross from other committee. Talk kept going.
Where in the present goes to say how many jurors? Oh, wait, you're not saying that. Okay. Constitution say the number of grand jurors?
Yeah, it says seven. And then it also says five must concur to find an indictment. So presumably you could construe that even though you got seven, and that's your grand jury, only five of them are there, and if they all five
over... Well, trial juries, they permit that to occur. Or when they become sick, go ahead with 11, and they come back as long as they got the requisite number for a verdict. Right?
We felt this was ambiguous and we ought to clear it out for good.
What is on a true bill? The grand jurors, do they each sign it? Just the foreman?
No, just the foreman.
How the hell do you know how many concurred anyway?
You don't.
You do now, because they have to report into court. And under the present procedure in many counties, the judge asks them, did five or more concur before they accept indictments?
But that's not uniform. They don't do that in every county.
No, not every county. That
just depends on what your local court rule happens to be.
That might be a good thing to get in here.
Well.
How about 66? Requires a member of a grand jury to disclose. Do you think that implies that they have to keep minutes, or is it just playing a memory situation?
Well, there would be memory involved, but there would be minutes available, presumably, that
the clerk keeps minutes.
Yeah, and those would be retained, except in those cases where, and it wouldn't apply. Of course, if the minutes are destroyed, where you've got a not true bill, you don't have any records, and it wouldn't. Here, you've obviously talking about a situation where there has been an indictment, so the only thing we do here, that's present law, except we put in false swearing in addition to perjury.
That comes from another statute. You're just combining two statutes then.
Well, you see, the disclosure may be required now for, again, if there's a person charged with perjury. We think the same thing should apply to the lesser crime of false swearing. Now, the section I was trying to think of earlier, Senator, section 72 with respect to this five juror thing.
Yeah, I saw.
You see, we require there, if at least five jurors voting or indictment before indictment will present, heard all the testimony relating to the person. In other words, you got to be the same five. You can't switch. Have one five one time hear part of the testimony, and then have a different five jurors. If you're going to go with five, they got to be the same five.
What is this old language about presentment that you say is taken out? What's the common law power of presentment?
Now, we had some interesting discussions about that, Senator. The presentment we felt with respect to individuals other than persons indicted that it was redundant and unnecessary to say presentment. Now, and there's one theory is that the reason you
44 in the yellow book.
Under the old law, under common law, the reason you had presentment was that so that the grand jury could present the prosecutor. That's one theory. I'm not sure whether that's accurate or not. We felt that, however, for the purposes of presenting material to the court, for the purposes of having further instructions from the court, this type of thing, that the presentment in that sense should be retained. But otherwise, if you're talking about a charge against an individual, a formal charge by a grand jury, indictment would cover it.
If the committee would look at section 80 on page 47, language has been deleted that allows the grand jury to inquire into the courts. And in my opinion, it ought to be in there that they could inquire into the courts if they wanted to. It's the last line in the first paragraph of Section 80.
Are they referring to all courts there when they say "and of the offices pertaining to the courts of justice"?
I assume so.
How does this work out in actual practice? I've never been on a grand jury at that particular moment, and you read about it in the paper. Do they do it on their own initiative, or is that part of the DA's job of getting them stirred up, or what?
The DA arranges for the bus transportation, lets them know when they're going to go, and usually calls out the jail, lets them know when they're coming, and the judge.
Once in a while they go on their own, though.
Well, does it happen on a certain day of the month or a certain week of the year?
Section of the day. Every grand jury puts out a boilerplate report.
Well, the grand jury didn't
let them. They went into the nursing homes in Multnomah last time. And they went into the courts in Lane County.
They had an election for DA last night. During that, they went into the nursing homes.
Well, isn't a grand jury is only good for, what, it's 90 days, isn't it?
Yeah.
And this says once a year. It doesn't say what part of the year. Am I reading this correctly?
Well, it says at least.
Well, it says...
That would be new.
That's new. At least one,
yeah,
once yearly is new. Before that, I think they always took the grand jury out of our correctional facilities, didn't they, John?
Page 47. Yeah, they always took them out.
Every
grand jury went out.
On the third Monday of each month, they had a grand jury.
But they didn't go to the courts very often, I don't think.
Oh boy, in the old days, our court didn't do that.
I tried to find some case law in Oregon with respect to this investigation of the courts. I couldn't find anything.
Why did they take it out?
Well, we weren't sure what it meant, for one thing. The regular practice has been to investigate the jail. But it's a rare instance where they investigate the courts. Furthermore, with respect to the court, the grand jury is an arm of the circuit court, and you have a rather anomalous situation of the grand jury investigating its own court. You also have further, with respect to any malfeasance or other suspected shortcomings as far as the judges are concerned, you have other avenues open under the Judicial Fitness Commission.
Well, that never does anything.
Well, we heard testimony to the contrary, Senator. In fact, House Judiciary this session heard a lot of testimony to the contrary with respect to the activities of the Judicial Fitness Commission.
They say they forced a couple of judges to resign.
Sorry?
They say. I don't know.
But the commission did feel, with respect to the correctional facilities, that it was desirable. Now it's just discretionary, although it's common practice for every grand jury to get the cook's tour of the jailhouse. And then we wrote in juvenile training school because, by definition, it's not a correctional facility. But under the existing statute, it's interesting that investigations have been made of institutions such as a nursing home. I would submit there's no existing statutory authority for the grand jury to investigate a nursing home except for possible criminal activity. As far as just checking in to see whether it's administratively being run well or not, I don't think the grand jury has any authority to do that under existing statutes.
Could have they thought a crime would be committed?
Right. Because 132.440, except for the bold print that we put in here, those are the powers and duties other than inquiry into crime. And those have been the only powers the grand jury's had for years and years in this state.
What's the penalty if the grand jury doesn't do it?
Call a special grand jury and indict them.
Suppose the judge loses his calendar. Doesn't know they didn't do it.
I think I found out why the judges always thank the grand jury so profusely each time they return something and tell how great they are.
As their voters?
No. And of the offices pertaining to the courts of justice therein. They investigate them too.
Thanking them for not having done it.
The commentary on page 50 about permissive joinder, would you go into that a little bit? Compulsory joinder and permissive joinder?
Yeah, now here we're talking about a different kind of joinder. We're talking about joinder of counts and charges in an indictment. And this is not changed from the existing law. But under subsection 2, where there are several charges against any person or persons, instead of having several indictments, the whole may be joined in one indictment. And then if there are two or more indictments, the court may order them consolidated. This is the permissive joinder of offenses. And the reason we put it in here was because we're to attempt to avoid any misunderstanding as the relationship of this statute with the compulsory joinder that's required under the former Jeopardy article. There, if it's if conduct or the offenses all grow out of the same criminal episode, the district attorney has no choice, or he would have no choice under our proposal, but to bring them all in the same trial.
Senator Burns.
Back on section 56, there are some suggestions made there. Neither the grand jury panel or any, that's on page 36, or any individual juror may be challenged, but the court may at any time after juror is drawn refuse to swear him upon finding that the juror is disqualified from service or discharge him. That was suggested.
Or discharge, yes. The bar committee, I believe, made that recommendation.
Right. Have we got amendments to that?
John?
The only thing that we have is, again, on this thing entitled Article 1 Testimony. If you go back to the third page from the back, under Article 3 Amendments and Reasons, under Section 56, you have that amendment stated.
Third page from the back?
Yes.
Third or second?
Third. Should be the third page from the back, under Section 56, entitled Article 3 Amendments and Reasons.
I so move. I've got it. I must have two hooked together.
Okay, Senator John Burns moves in Section 56.
What are the
that
reasons?
That wouldn't be 56 in the bill, though,
is it? Section 36, page 14.
In Section 36, page 14 of the bill.
What are the reasons in 10.040?
In what now, Senator?
Well, the last part of that, the 132.030.
Oh, what 3? Oh. Yeah. They are.
I don't care. I just want to know what I'm voting.
10.040 is persons exempt from duty if he's a judge, he's an officer of the United States whose duties at the time are inconsistent with his duty as a juror, if he's an attorney, If he's a practicing physician, dentist, optometrist, chiropractor, osteopath, Christian Science practitioner, naturopath, or undertaker.
How about dry cleaners?
Well, that's kind of like an undertaker.
Well, yeah, they clean other people's linen, but then they're busy too.
If he's a member of the Senate or House, if he's active in the National Guard, or if his health is bad, or if he's over the age of 70.
You're not reading.
Yeah, I am.
Verbatim, aren't
you? Yeah. I'm not going to ask you to read 10.05, but just to summarize it.
That's what
shouldn't
it
that
is.
Be, a John, citizen refuse to swear him or discharge him? Shouldn't it be say to refuse to swear or discharge him?
Yeah, if he's from Benton County.
I guess that's what they want to put in, I think.
Well, that is the way.
No, it says refuse to swear him or discharge him upon a finding that the juror is disqualified.
So we just put or discharge in between swear and him, right?
On line 32 after him, you put or discharge him before upon a finding.
Why not just say refuse to swear or discharge him?
Why say refuse to swear? Why not just say just discharge him if he comes under those?
Refuse to swear him or discharge him, or refuse to swear or discharge him?
Discharge him upon finding that the juror is disqualified. Why do you have to have refuse to swear?
Well, he may find out before he's been sworn.
Oh. You know, he didn't know he was in the Army. Or if he's a chiropractor, as soon as you find out, then you can discharge.
Right.
A good judge would ask.
What are you suggesting?
I don't know why you... I'm just...
parallel construction.
You're going to go over my head.
Refuse to swear him or discharge him.
I don't care. It's only a suggestion.
Right. Those in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The amendment carries.
Now over on section 61, interpreters spelled wrong. Is that picked up in the bill?
Where?
Section 61 of page 38. That would be what section?
39, section 39 in the bill.
39, is that correct in the bill?
Yeah.
No, it's still spelled wrong. Isn't an interpreter got OR on the end rather than ER?
Well, we want to be picturesque.
You mean it's interpretor instead of interpreter?
I thought, am I wrong? It was in the old legislation the same way, I guess.
John, you want to look it up?
Okay. I think it's ER.
Okay,
I think ER is correct spelling.
I may be wrong.
I have it.
It was once before.
Somebody asked for a guard.
Yeah, here in our amendments, we've got a proposed amendment to 61.
Is that what you spell the spelling?
No.
After the word or guard, yes. Sounds reasonable.
Yeah. What's 61, Don?
Section 61 in the book.
Yeah.
That's section 39 in the bill.
In section 39 of the bill, on page 15, no, page 16,
it's up on line 3, page 16. May appoint an interpreter or guard.
Just the word guard. On line 3, on page 16, right after the word interpreter, insert the word guard.
I move.
It's been so moved that we add the word guard after the word interpreter on page 16 and line 3. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes. We have a proposed amendment on 68. This is the one that allows them to experts to submit their reports, and even though it's hearsay, it can be considered by the grand jury, and Judge Alderson raises a point as whether the jury should consider this as facts or should consider it as opinions. It's in the last line of the newly added language. It's on page 18 of the bill, line 5. Whether the expert's report is a report of facts or opinions. Anybody concerned about it?
If anybody is concerned, would it suffice to say shall be received in evidence in grand jury proceeding, period?
But it says.
No. It says as
put
evidence.
Put a period after evidence and delete the rest.
Shall be received in evidence in the grand jury proceeding.
Or received as evidence therein? Or do you have to have grand jury proceeding?
That's okay.
Why can't you just put evidence, period?
Could.
Super commission.
Shall be received in evidence. Shall be received in evidence in the grand jury proceeding, I think makes it more
right.
Precise.
In evidence.
In the grand
jury. In the grand jury proceeding.
Period.
And strike of the facts therein.
I'd like to ask a question, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, just.
Oh, you're going to hold on, Mr. Chairman.
On line 5 of 18 of the bill, insert the word in before evidence, and after the word evidence, in the grand jury proceeding, and strike of the facts stated therein. Okay, Nick.
Well, I want to ask a question about Section 68.
Oh, well, let's go on this amendment first. Oh. You've heard the amendment on line 5, page 18. All those in favor of the amendment say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment passes. Okay, Nick.
Well, on page 41 at the bottom, in Section 68, there's sub 1. It says, receive no other evidence than such as might be given on the trial of the person charged. That sounds like a prayer to me. In the first place, who's going to judge? certainly the grand jury is not going to testify against itself. And it's a figment of the district attorney.
Well, in subsection 2, what we just amended is hearsay evidence, but there's an exception in one that kind of hearsay can be accepted.
Yeah, I understand that, but that's the only exact part of the whole thing. Anybody else could run off the mouth as much as they wanted to, and if the district attorney wanted them to, who'd stop them and who'd check on them? What I'm trying to ask here is really, what does the grand jury do that's important that anybody proves that they have to do it right?
Okay, Nan.
Well, I think as long as it doesn't mean anything, why not strike the whole bloody thing?
Well, for one thing, since grand jury inquiries are are conducted under the direction of the and through the legal counsel of the district attorney. And also because it's the general practice in the state, I think, for the district attorneys to advise the... Well, they get advice, first of all, from the court with respect to what their duties are. And I think the practice generally is the district attorneys tell them when they're presenting the case that the kind of evidence that they're entitled to hear and that the case and the testimony that they are presenting must measure up to the kind of test that would be subject to at a trial. It doesn't do a district attorney any good to get an indictment on evidence that would not be admissible in a trial.
But he doesn't have to use that evidence. He can use something else in a trial, can he?
Sure, presumably he could. And
what protection does the guy that's being indicted have to be sure that the district attorney has properly instructed the grand jury and they lived up to those instructions?
Faith in the system.
Well, look, I don't belong to that church.
That's the best I can give you, friend. That's and I'm not trying to be facetious.
Well, you're honest, but it's not.
As a practical matter, if you as a defendant feel that you were, indicted without evidence to substantiate that, you're not going to be convicted. You might be able to move to quash the indictment. If there were irregularities in the grand jury proceeding,
does the indictment have to state all this evidence?
No.
How do you know what was said?
The defendant does not know what was said.
So then how does he know that it was proper evidence?
He doesn't.
Then what good is it?
Well, for one thing, it's an admonition in the statement of policy by the legislature, and there is a presumption that public servants follow the law.
Well, they most legislators do follow the law now that the old criminal code is repealed.
Madam Chairman, on 68,
it's a little bit deep, but
the note chip we have says that the district attorney suggested a reasonable cause be changed to probable cause, but I don't find that in the 68 anyplace. Is there a place in there that talks about reasonable cause and probable cause?
I just want to keep you guys honest.
Well, 68? I don't think there was some amendment proposed to put it in there. I'm not. It isn't in there now.
Another generation is off on
this. I've been called a hippie lately, but not a hippie.
I told Cook no puns.
Well.
Oh, 68 the bill? Was it 68 the bill you were referring to?
I don't know what they're referring to. It's just a
quote.
We aren't there yet. The bill is 101, 102 in the section. In the
book.
Those are the DA's amendments. Well, is there a problem?
About what?
I don't know. What we're hung up on.
We're not hung up on anything. We're waiting to go to the next section.
They say that 82 and what?
No, I was going to say, you got a problem? You need a friend called Grace Peck.
There are two comments that 82 and 83 are confusing, setting forth the matters the indictment has to contain, and then setting forth the indictment itself. Why did you do both things, Don?
Well, for one thing, we felt that and particularly if you look at 82, you'll see the language that we did delete, we felt was covered by 83. Now there are two sections, we felt we'd stay with two sections and try not to be redundant.
You don't think they're repetitious?
No. You took good notes.
I think they would have been had we not proposed to delete A and B and F of the of subsection 1 of existing 132.540.
Madam Chairman, are these notes we got here, you're referring to the bill sections here, right?
To the book section.
The stuff I got here referring to the
All right, look at section 85 in the book. Judge Alderson suggests that the name of the reporter be endorsed on the indictment.
The name of the reporter?
That's what it says.
There is not customarily a reporter in the grand jury.
No, but one can be required, can't they, Don?
Under some circumstances.
They have to get an order from the court.
Yes.
I think I know what he's getting at, Madam Chairman, but I can look at it from an inverse point of view, and if I were defending a criminal case and the DA was arguing the indictment and the jury looked at the indictment and saw the name of the court reporter on the indictment, knowing, and no offense, Senator Hoyt, but knowing the reasoning that some jurors use, they might give greater credence to that indictment with the name of the court reporter on there.
Especially the one that's sitting there reporting the case.
That's right.
And then he suggests striking section 88 because it may not the evidence might not comply with 133.610. What's that, the Miranda warning?
Yes, warnings. It's not exactly Miranda warning. It's similar to it about his rights under the law. The 136.545 now covers both grand jury and trial.
133.545
is the existing statute. And we just restated part of it here in section 88.
Not 545.
I told you.
She's getting awful touchy. Yeah, she just wants a quorum. Now she wants everybody. She'll be asking for cook pretty soon.
Let's have a motion then on Article
3.
Okay, discussion.
Well, I've got some other notes here I don't know how. First place, I'd like to go back to this matter on section 68, where we talk about the scientific reporter or whatever it is.
Okay.
I'm wondering where that type of testimony is submitted. If it shouldn't be required that the name that the person who submitted that testimony would be.
Be included as a witness on the indictment?
Well, it certainly should say where the information came from.
Well, if you testify in front of the grand jury, your name is inscribed upon the indictment.
Yeah, but see, this allows them to submit a report. Expert witnesses can submit a report in Section 68 instead of being personally present.
We kind of whittled that down at the end. Maybe you ought to stick in someplace that the guy ought to sign.
That's a good idea.
I think that's probably a good idea.
I so move.
Let's see, where will we put it?
Now, you're going to have to make some qualifications on there. Because the present language says the name of every witness who appeared before the grand jury.
All right, a witness examined before the grand jury or whose report was considered by the grand jury.
But I think it should distinguish on the indictment.
Well, report is a report.
I think if you distinguish what by an asterisk or something, then you're getting into problems.
It should be in Section 85. What do you suggest, Tom?
Yes, that's where I think it should go. Yes, in Section 85.
What should the words be?
Well, heretofore, up until now, even then.
Well, I would think we could say when an indictment is found, the name of the witnesses examined before the grand, the names of the witnesses examined before the grand jury, or whose report was received by the grand jury under subsection 2 of ORS 132.320.
Now, precisely where does that go?
Turn off the fan.
Examine before.
What page in the bill are you on? Of the bill. The last line, 34. The names of the witnesses examined before the grand jury or whose report was received by the grand jury. That's all right, isn't it?
No, I don't think so.
All right, on line 34 of page 22, after grand jury, insert the word or whose report was received by the grand jury.
After, before, a witness
examined. After jury and before that, or whose report was received by the grand jury.
I so move.
Thank you.
I move to amend the
pursuant to what?
Well, I was just going to have a cross reference to the
we don't really
that
need
allow,
it, do
that allows it.
You just kind of been doing it.
Do we need it?
Well, to the extent that we want to make sure we're just talking about the reports
okay,
of these
pursuant
experts.
Pursuant to what?
Sub 2 of 132.
Pursuant to flag and legislative
huh?
Council. Oh, yeah.
Subsection 2 of ORS 132.320.
Okay. That's the amendment.
I got an amendment to the amendment, Richard.
All right. What's your amendment?
After the language to be inserted, I put a comma and add, in which case it shall be so indicated, comma.
Okay. I call for a question on the amendment to the amendment. We'll dispose of that.
Question. All those in favor of putting a question on the amendment to the amendment?
Well, I withdraw that.
But it's self-evident.
It isn't self-evident.
Or whose report was received.
Right. So you put his name down there just like any other witness and didn't even appear before that. I think defense counsel is entitled to know it.
Well, he's going to know.
He may never
know. Under the pretrial discovery article, anyway.
Well, wait a minute. The whole thing's underwritten on here, isn't it? Doesn't the defense lawyer get to see the indictment?
No.
I didn't see who signed it.
Well, what he's saying is he can't tell from what's inscribed on the indictment whether the grand jury saw the expert in the flesh or whether it was one of these reports.
Well, that was my intention of my amendment, was that if a guy just submitted a report that had his name, it had to be in the record and on the indictment. If he gives it in person, it's got to be on an indictment.
Yeah, right.
My point was that if the guy's not there, but he sends his papers...
Okay. What my amendment would do would indicate those instances where he just submitted the report and didn't appear in person.
That's all I'm talking about.
All right, what words do you want?
I say, which case it shall be so indicated.
How are you going to do it,
Madam Chairman?
Going back to Section 68, he has to certify it, the person that makes the report. Wouldn't that be sufficient?
No, I'm not challenging that part of it all, George. I'm just saying that on the indictment where they list the name of the witnesses, they ought to distinguish between those who appeared in the flesh and those who did it by way of report. That's all I'm trying to read.
I don't understand practically how you're going to notify that without making it appear to be an irregularity in the form of the indictment. My problem is this. Getting back to the jury again. You put an asterisk or something there, And so Joe Blow comes in and testifies in front of the jury at the trial. Some wise juror sees that there's an asterisk next to his name on the indictment, and he suddenly gets into his mind, boy, they must have really relied upon his testimony in front of the grand jury, and gives undue weight to his testimony at the time of trial. I'm sympathetic, Keith, but I think that the fear is that you express is probably not as great of a fear now on the proposed pretrial discovery procedure as it may have been in the past. And I know from talking to jurors in criminal cases in days gone past when we could, that they come up with the weirdest things. Like, for example, well, we found him guilty because he was indicted, and if the grand jury indicted him, he must be guilty. That's why I question the.
What about putting the ORS section there for his name? The same thing.
Don, do you think that's any adequate language for what Keith has in mind?
Spelled FORGETIT.
Divided into different words.
Well, I suppose you could add a sentence to the effect that if the witness submitted a report under ORS.
Well, we've already got an ORS in there. We don't need that again.
Why not? What's the matter with my language? In which case it shall be so indicated.
How is it going to be indicated?
If I was a district attorney, I'd feel if I put the code, the ORS citation after his name, that would do it.
Well, maybe on the face plane up under the title of next to the caption, instead of have that additional ORS number on the face next to the reference to the crime.
Well, or Senator, you could say the endorsement shall indicate.
It's a new sentence.
Yes, which would go at the end of subsection one. The endorsement shall show whether the witness gave testimony before the grand jury or submitted a report.
That's exactly what I have in mind.
Now,
okay, John Byrne.
Is this after the word filed?
Yes.
Yeah.
Then how would it show, practically?
Well, I don't think it matters as long as it shows whether after the witness's name at the foot of the indictment, you show oral testimony. After one who gave a report, you show written report.
Right. We're now considering two amendments. The First Amendment is on line 34, page 22, and after the word grand jury is inserted, or whose report was received by the grand jury pursuant to subsection 2 of 132.300. And on page 23, on line 2, after the word filed, the endorsement shall show whether the witness gave testimony before the grand jury or filed a report. All in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, the amendment carries.
Did we, on
now,
page 71, on page 71, did we make a change there that the Multnomah County DA wanted on section 70? It's been so long since we got it there, I can't remember.
Section 70?
Section 70. You suggested that instead of when required by the grand jury, it just says shall prepare indictments. I don't know if that's important or just a matter of semantics. The Mono County DA was asked for that.
Must shall.
We wanted to change that whole phrase.
Well, actually,
the word shall.
He has the discretion whether to bring it before the grand jury or not. I don't really think it's too important.
Okay.
Is anybody else?
Then I have a question. I have page 82 of the yellow book pretty well marked up. I'm on page 48. And what I've written down here said one of the questions was, could 82 and 83 be combined? And
yeah,
I don't know what I have in mind.
And we talked about that,
but
and Don said he felt they were not redundant. And as I gathered from the committee, you felt they weren't redundant, that they...
Certainly, I would agree they could be combined. Sure, I don't disagree with that. We could have combined them, and you could combine them now if the committee decided.
Not worth the bother.
I'm not sure that you accomplished a whole lot, but...
Then on that same page, page 48, I have a note after sub 2 there under section 82, and I got the note except for ex-convict, not convict, and I don't know what I'm
weapon.
Huh?
Ex-convict, convict in possession of a weapon or something like that. We discussed before.
Well,
did we discuss that today?
Not today.
I think that was a DA's amendment, I think.
I can't remember.
Oh. I'm not sure whether it said ex-con in possession or except for crimes where possession or something that is material.
Except for a material element.
I would think that'd be a reasonable amendment.
Word it.
They're doing it anyway.
Word it for us.
Was this in section 82?
I think the DA submitted some proposed language.
Yeah, there is some there on subsection 2 of 82. Can't be that. Oh, yeah. The indictment shall not contain allegations that the defendant was previously been convicted of a violation of any statute which may subject him to enhanced penalties, except where conviction constitutes an element of the crime charge.
What are the necessary words?
Except where conviction constitutes an element of
material
crime
element.
Charge.
Does that mean life or?
A material element instead of an element?
Where?
Here, okay.
they suggested.
Just subsection 2?
Yeah, at the end of subsection 2.
Okay, except...
Material element.
A material element.
Where the allegations...
Except where conviction constitutes.
Where the conviction...
A material element for the crime charge.
Would that be like ex-convict with a pistol?
Yeah. I don't know. I'm just reading here. I haven't figured out what it says.
Well, that would be
is it
example.
Crime or offense?
Well, you wait to pass it off. I've been busy for you.
Crime.
Well, we think for the purposes of the grand jury statutes, crime is...
But except for
you're not going to be charging violations under an indictment.
What situation are we talking about here?
Well, like an ex-con in possession would be an example where that is material for prior conviction.
Alderson and Greg Lowe is what? He's with the DA, Multnomah County DA? Where is he?
Yes, he's with Multnomah County.
He and Alderson both... Not be confused.
How high did they go?
Kickers. You left on the front.
Yeah, I know.
All right, the amendment goes on line 24 of page 21 of the bill and reads, the period is struck and the words added are, except where the conviction constitutes a material element of the crime charge, period. All those in favor of the amendment say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment carries. Senator John Burns moved the adoption of Article 3. Discussion.
I just had one other question I wanted to bring up, if I could, with
okay.
respect to Section 58 in the bill.
Page.
Which is Section 83 in your book, and that begins on page 21, the bottom of page 21, but the pertinent part is over on page 22, under sub 8, provide signatures of the foreman of the district attorney and the date on which each signed. The bar committee, I know, had recommended that they didn't think that served any worthwhile purpose, that it could provide additional matter for contention that would complicate and retard the criminal process. They recommend the deletion of the words and the date on which each signed.
So
all right, the motion is to strike on page 22, line 29, the words and the, and on the lines 30, date on which each signed. Senator Keith Burns.
What harm does that do? What's their complaint about that?
Just adds more material
to
cause a possible error.
No lawyers make any mistakes.
I agree.
Is that bad, John?
Yeah, I think the material thing is the date on which the indictment's returned, and knowing how DAs and foremen are scurrying around trying to sign these. I think that it, as Don, as the bar committee suggested, it just...
Well, it, there is
provide,
no other...
Doesn't provide
call.
For a date, does it?
Yeah.
Where?
There is no other requirement for a date.
Well, it says right there, page 49 of the yellow book, number 8.
Yeah, but we're just striking that.
Yeah, we're all
Senator Smith, Smith's...
No, right up above.
Oh.
Up there. Dated at blank date in the county aforesaid, the date is returned right up there in the italicized portion.
Well, that's the deleted portion.
Well, it says the indictment shall contain substantially the following. So there isn't any requirement that being there.
although logically.
Well, that whole material at the top of 22 is being struck.
Correct.
And it's only what's on page 21, and there's no date on that
you
either.
7-9, the date.
Well, that's
the date. That's
being deleted.
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 Return.
Right. Deal, that's what we're in trouble with.
Well, would I agree the date should be in there, but I don't think the date that they each sign has to be in there. And the date?
The indictment was filed with the clerk. Mm-hmm. All right, number 9. All right, we'll vote on Senator Smith's amendment first. Just wait, we're going to vote on Smith's amendment first. Deleting on line 29 and the date on which each signed. All in favor say aye.
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 No.
Opposed? All right. The motion passes. Then Senator John Burns moves to add a sub 9. The date on which...
The date the indictment is filed with the court.
No, it's filed with the clerk. That's in the new code. Okay. You don't take it to the court, you take it in there, right?
Yeah, we propose it just be filed.
All right.
Just filed. You don't have to report into, under our proposal, you don't have to report into the judge.
All right. Sub 9 is proposed on page 22 between lines 30 and 31. Sub 9, the date the indictment is filed with the clerk of the court. All in favor of the amendment say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment carries. John Burns moves the adoption of Article 3. Discussion? Clerk call the roll.
Senator John Burns. Senator
Cooper?
Aye.
Senator Fibers?
Aye.
Senator
Hoyt?
Aye.
Senator Smith?
Aye.
Madam
Chair?
Aye.
Well,
we're doing quite a bit of work today.
We got more to do.
Oh. Let's both go eat at the same time.
Well, she'll be there the day before you are.
All right, Section 4, Article 4.
There's only one door. It's contrary to fire law, but it sure helps to keep someone
going
to
get pulled down.
Oh, the jewel we just passed was Article 3, right?
Mm-hmm. Now, the first amendment we have in Article 4 is in Section 90. Which is section 63, line 31. The word crime is should be offense. Is that right, Don?
Yes. May I ask a question?
Yes.
Would it be simpler for us to be working from the bill than from the yellow book?
I am.
Well, the problem is that these notes we got here in amendments.
Yeah, you have to use both, really.
Refer to parts of them. Refer to the book.
The
and parts DA's of them refer to the bill.
Amendments relate to the note to the bill, don't they? Yeah.
I think going into section for Article 4, they should relate only to the bill. Also, the other.
The okay.
Okay.
All right. The First Amendment is on page 23 of the bill, line 31. The word crime is struck and the word offense is substituted. All in favor. That motion is made by Senator Hoyt. All in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion carries.
Now, I want to ask a question.
John Burns?
I've got a hang-up, and that hang-up relates to the use
of the word peace officer, and I believe in a very restrictive use of that word, and I just want Don to explain its use here as it's used in section 62 in the PRIL. It's broader than the definition of peace officer used in search and seizure, which is right, but it's more restrictive than the definition in 161.015. And,
yes,
that definition in 015 relates to what?
Well, that the definition there goes on to say, and such other persons as may be authorized
by law.
What's
that applicable to?
Well, that would pick up people who, under some other statute, are authorized to act as peace officers. For example, a liquor investigator.
All right. Okay.
Liquor control commission.
Okay. Now here we're talking. Here we're talking about
special peace officers.
Okay, I agree with this. This
takes a middle ground.
This. Yeah. Right. Okay, this is fine.
Well, who are we going to get to monitor the Gaujai dances out of cruising?
You got a unique way of handling whatever type of law enforcement problems come up.
I'm in transfer there.
That's against the law, too.
Who taught that guy the word monitor? That's about an East Northern word. That's
monitor?
The name of a town.
That's right. It's located near Buchanan, isn't it? That's close to Buchanan.
All right. Once again, we have the same recommendation that Section 63 and Section 64 are repetitive and redundant and should be combined. Don, what do you have to say to that?
Well, again, just what I said in the previous one, certainly you could combine them. We felt that they were not redundant, that they contained different matter. They're stated two different ways, and, you know, under the old provision, and it that came from the grand jury statute. This was just a form of an indictment, and we took the form out and set it out in terms of
30 seconds
of sentences to read rather than looking at a form. I felt it was better drafting. I suppose somewhat of an arbitrary decision that you make one way or another, whether you put it in one section or another, or in two.
I think the suggested language was that you added a section that says a 90, and it can be understood there from that, and then set down section 90 underneath it. I felt it would be less confusing than having the two separate sections. That was suggested. That doesn't make much sense, because then you say it can be understood there from that the defendant is named, or if his name cannot be discovered.
Does anybody have a strong feeling they want to redrafting of these two sections? The next comment we have is on section 68. Don, do you have the proposed amendments on it? Do you have these?
No, I don't think I have those.
Is that on two that they about peace officers? Oh no, I'm sorry. That's a different section. It's over 71.
A penalty for failure to appear on a citation.
Well,
I guess it's section 94 in the yellow book, and section 66 in the bill, and they recommend that anybody, well, recommend changing misdemeanor to a Class A misdemeanor. It already is.
That's what we have in the bill.
Yeah. Another recommendation goes to 133060, which isn't in the bill.
Appears on page 54 of the yellow book. 133060.
Who's making that recommendation? It's not on the DA's thing.
I don't know the source.
Now, these aren't just the DA's deal. Don't you have them all in
here? New set of amendments to Article 4.
Ash Mansfish, yeah, he's the city attorney in
let me know at 6:30.
Well, this statute isn't in the book. Does anybody want to?
It's in the
book. Yeah, I know it's in the yellow book, but it's not in the bill.
I suggest as a matter of policy.
I do too.
That we just. Good.
It's a good policy. I go for it.
Good.
Well, wait. What's the? Are we covering this twice, or what are we doing?
No.
Huh?
No.
Well, I gather he's trying to make two points. One, that the existing statute does not cover a subsequent time and date that was set by the court that might be different than in the citation. He shows up once, but he doesn't show up the second time.
Well,
and then the second is that by saying court instead of magistrate, that you would cover city courts who are not magistrates.
There is some problem about JPs don't have jurisdiction of some Class A misdemeanors, but Bob and I have a bill in which will take care of that, so I don't think we need to bother with that.
I give a lot more credence to this underlined thing here if it was a district attorney that came in. It's practically not a problem. Change 102 to read probable cause.
He'll change it consistently through the bill. Section 71 is the no-knock provision in subsection 7. Then could the destruction of evidence be limited to drugs? What other kind of evidence would they dispose of?
Well, I think that's the most likely kind of case, but I mean, you could have destruction of physical evidence in a in a forgery case, or you have...
Well, you can't swallow a steel plate.
No, you can't swallow it, but you could...
I heard that.
You could...
But you could say that...
Or if you had forged credit cards, or if you had... other evidence that would be easily burned, or this type of thing. I don't think it's necessarily limited to drug cases. I think that's where it usually comes up, because those kind of situations...
But if it's not limited, that gives the officer almost unlimited authority.
It gives him unlimited authority, because you'd still have to make some showing that he reasonably believed the evidence was going to be destroyed if he gave the notice that's required under subsection 6. I don't think the cases allow that now. This is a hard area to, but I would certainly hate to see it limited just to drug cases. It's just too hard to conjure up all the different kinds of cases where you might have evidence that's readily destroyed.
When a policeman locks a door down to get in, other seven, who pays to fix the door? Something I always wondered about.
We're going to take care of that in the landlord, too.
You know, for a dummy like me, that's a sensible question. Don't make fun of an old man.
Every case I've
What section is that in the book?
In the yellow book, that's section 106 of the book.
Well, on the proposed amendments, we have a couple proposed amendments. I don't think they amount to anything.
If I may, I'd call your attention again to a recommendation from the Bar Committee on this same section, section 106, under subsection 3. This is section 71 of the bill. It appears on page 27. With respect to showing the warrant, and under their proposal is that under sub 3, where it says the officer shall inform the person to be arrested of his authority and reason for the arrest. New language would be after arrest, insert, and if the arrest is under a warrant, comma, shall show the warrant, comma.
But the sub 4 says when arresting a person under a warrant, the peace officer, or upon the request of the arrest, shall show the warrant. All right, the suggested amendment is to sub 3 of 106 in the yellow book and sub 3 of 71.
So we'll move and strike 4 then, in the same motion.
I missed something. They also go on in that same subsection where it says inform the arrested person after person. Insert and show the warrant, comma, if any.
Restate the proposal.
It's on line 11 after the word arrest, and if the arrest is under a warrant, shall show, comma, shall show the warrant. And on line 13, after the word person, add the language and show the warrant. If any. And then Senator Smith's motion was to strike sub 4. Renumber the rest of the subsections appropriately. So sub 3 reads, the officer shall inform the person to be arrested of his authority and the reason for the arrest, and if the arrest is under a warrant, shall show the warrant, unless he encounters physical resistance, flight, or other factors rendering the procedure impractical, in which case the arresting officer shall inform the arrested person and show the warrant, if any, as soon as practicable. Sub 4 is stricken. Discussion on the motion.
Now, we have really just kind of combined this, haven't we?
Right.
We haven't made some substantive changes, have you, speak of? Except you don't have to read it while you're running.
Yeah.
Well, no, before you had to request the warrant before it was shown to him.
Yes, that's right.
Now they have to show it to you.
Thank you.
All in favor of the motion, say aye.
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 Aye. Opposed?
The
motion carries.
You can tell when he's getting about 6 o'clock.
No, it's almost 7.
Daddy, you're going to take a lot of kidding the next 2 weeks. I hope
yeah.
you can hold up. We'll stay with you so we can kid you.
Thanks.
I'll stay with her because I have to. She gets mad if I leave.
You got some. Is he here?
How about this sentence, Don, in page section 107 of the Yellow Book, page 61, the last sentence, an arrest shall not be considered to have been made on insufficient cause under this section solely on the ground that the officer is unable to determine the particular offense which may have been committed. Doesn't that give you a chance to go fishing?
Sure, it's just
well, I suppose to a certain extent you can say, but you still have to be somewhere in the ballpark. You've got to have probable cause to make your arrest, and it certainly isn't contrary to the practice now to have an arrest made, say, for. A second degree offense, say second degree theft or second degree burglary, and have the charge, the formal charge that's filed, be a first degree offense, or have an arrest made for an assault that turns out to be filed as harassment or something like that.
Well, is that what this says, though?
Yeah.
Is it really? I understand what you're saying, and I would agree with you, but I don't. My paltry grasp of language doesn't give me that information.
In other words, it wouldn't allow him to arrest since this is limited to crime.
Wouldn't
I mean
as long as it's a serious enough offense to authorize the arrest without a warrant. The mere fact that the officer picks the wrong charge doesn't validate the arrest. And I think that's existing law.
I was going to ask you, what is existing
law? I think that is existing law.
Are we on 72?
This is a change, though, in that it allows you to arrest for a misdemeanor on probable cause.
Yes, oh, definitely. And that is a change.
Yeah.
And that's probably the biggest change made in here, in this section.
I guess, because we downgraded the offenses,
that's essentially the reason. That's one of the things, because some of the offenses that previously were felonies or indictable misdemeanors under the new code are Class A misdemeanors.
So what would you say it again?
Some of the offenses that under the old law were either felonies or what were called indictable misdemeanors. They were felonies up until the time the judge imposed some sentence other than imprisonment in the penitentiary. Under the new code are now Class A misdemeanors. So you have some fairly serious offenses that are punishable by up to a year in jail and a $1,000 fine or both that the officer cannot arrest on probable cause. And we feel that it's good policy to allow these kinds of arrests. But at the same time, we didn't write in the limitation that it be a Class A misdemeanor because we think that would just unduly complicate the officer's job when he's deciding to make an arrest, whether he's got a Class A misdemeanor or a Class B misdemeanor with respect to the arrest. We didn't feel it should make that much difference. That the old in presence requirement was in this day and age outmoded and unnecessarily complicated law enforcement.
Senator Byrne.
What's the difference between subsection 4 and the old statutes if you needed subsection 2 on page 28 of the bill? What's the difference between the subsection 4 that you deleted and subsection 2 that you put in new? What's the difference in the effect?
But
this goes on and allows an officer to call in to a judge and get a warrant by telephone without a sworn statement.
Is this the section that does that?
Well, no, but it does someplace, doesn't it?
Well, no.
So that's under search warrants.
That's
you
under
can get
search
a search warrant by telephone.
Well, Dick, were you satisfied with the explanation on that last sentence? Line 28, page 28.
Is that... page 661 of the yellow book?
Yes.
Well, I don't know that I'm satisfied enough, but I'm sure not smart enough to say it any better and make it sound any sillier. But it may be that in the jargon of the police, this means something. To me, it's completely irresponsible.
The bar committee stated, and it's... its consideration of this section. Section 107 defines an officer's authority to arrest without a warrant. It changes present law by allowing an arrest on reasonable cause for a misdemeanor as well as a felony. Subsection 3 provides guidelines for determining the existence of reasonable cause. Prevents invalidation of an arrest for the sole reason that an officer cannot determine at the time the particular offense with which it appropriate to charge the arrested person. The committee believes that the noted matters are valuable additions to the law. That's the statement of the Bar Committee on Criminal Law and Procedure.
So, a crime We're talking about something greater than a Class A misdemeanor.
No. A crime includes any felony or any misdemeanor.
God. Well, what's different? An offense includes violations?
Yes. Yes. Because offense includes crimes and violations.
Okay.
Inflexible position of having to annul.
And under our proposal, if he's arresting on a violation, it would still have to be in his presence.
Does he show you if he had an offense?
Oh, he has to, though.
What does it say?
I'll be right back.
You're just allowed 2 minutes.
No.
You go, we all go.
Chairman, I move to adjourn. It's not a debatable motion.
Where does it say that? I surely must mean what you say, but that seems like the language.
I tell you, if we did adjourn, we could wear her gown faster because I know she'd have to stay here.
I see, well, Chairman, you do a good job. That's helpful.
And the rest. Well, the probable cause thing modifies that, Dick.
Well?
In other words, Senator Hoyt is concerned about the language in the last sentence of 107, which is
are you in the book?
Top of page 61 in the book.
Yeah.
And I'm saying, as you said, that if there's some flexibility isn't permitted there, you're putting the policeman in a irretractable position of having to elect, and if he elects wrong, he's out.
Well, I can't cite you any cases, Senator, any Oregon case at the present time, but I'd be very surprised to see this kind of an arrest invalidated now, because it's common practice.
I have a quarrel with what you say it means.
Yeah.
But when it says is unable to determine the particular offense, that means he doesn't know what the hell he's doing. And how do you know he's breaking the law?
No, that doesn't mean that.
Well, it says that, doesn't it?
No, it doesn't say that, I don't think, Senator. If your concern is that the officer thinks, yeah, I'd arrest this guy for some charge, and I don't know what, so I'll just make up a charge, he would not be able to do that because he still has to have probable cause to make the arrest.
But you have to read that in the context of probable cause, and you know what probable cause more likely than not that a crime has been committed.
We just wanted to clarify it that it shouldn't invalidate the arrest just because the officer says, I think you've committed the crime of assault, and it turns out to be something
else. I understand that. I just having trouble with that sentence. And you say something else that negates it, but the sentence says, an arrest shall not be considered to have made on insufficient cause. Now, insufficient cause must have some relation with probable cause. Under this section, solely on the ground that the officer is unable to determine the particular offense. Now, if this is a word, if these are words of art, that's okay with me. But in my kind of English, this is a pretty positive statement that a guy can figure out what he did after he caught him.
Starting on the bottom of page 60 there, the information may also include that received from an informant when it is reasonable under the circumstances to credit whether or not at the time of making the arrest the officer knows the informant's identity. How the hell can he give it any credit if he doesn't know his identity? On a search warrant, he's got to say that he knows him and he's used him before, he's proved to be reliable, and all kinds of things. Here he doesn't even have to know who he is.
You could have a statement made to an officer that a crime has been committed, or it could be a face-to-face statement, an informant stating something to the officer that without the officer knowing who the informant is.
It's way beyond present law, isn't it?
No, I don't think so.
You couldn't even have a search based on that.
Well, we're not talking about searches. We're talking about
arresting somebody.
And we're talking also about the information that's included under 3. This is just part of
it. Was said,
this is just part of subsection 3.
On the ground, the officer has not exactly specified.
He's allowed to take into account all information that a reasonably prudent officer would judge relevant to the likelihood that an offense has been committed.
the person to be arrested has committed.
On the ground that the officer is unable
so
to determine.
So that sentence that begins at the next last line.
No, yes. This is exclusive of everything else.
But if you see,
the information may also include
exactly
that received from an informant whom it is reasonable under the circumstances to credit. This is just part of the information the officer is entitled to take into account deciding whether or not he has probable cause to make a warrantless arrest.
At the end of the road, somebody has been shooting off a gun. That could be homicide.
We're going to have John Della back here,
be
Chairman. He's the only other guy I know that went into this kind of depth.
We don't need a prayer, we need some words.
No, but John always had always took an education any committee that he ever attended, and he wanted to know the big picture, so everybody had to educate him on every lousy little thing.
I just don't know.
He himself extended one session at least 2 months, that I know of.
Maybe
he ended up in
college.
You're hurting my feelings.
Are you trying to tell us something? I'm just explaining it. Now, that makes sense, doesn't it? So, it could be homicide, it could be assault, it could be malicious destruction of personal property. He doesn't know for sure which it is,
yes.
But he has reliable information. He's unable to determine which it is.
Huh?
Okay. Now, if you force him to rely upon upon homicide, and he goes in there and the guy is just shooting out the windows in his rented house, presumably you can't arrest him for malicious destruction.
This doesn't bother anybody else. I move
well,
on.
Well, that part doesn't bother me, but the other part does.
You follow me?
Yeah, I get your point, right? I know what you're trying to do. I approve of it.
But with respect to this other question, we're not saying here, at least I don't think we're saying, that you can arrest only upon the unidentified informant. We're saying that the information that makes up the sum total of the officer's knowledge may include this kind of information.
What's your point to speak to, Keith?
That he can rely upon in part an informant he can't identify. Doesn't know anything about
show?
It. Where does that show? The last sentence on the bottom 60 and it continues over on 61 in the book.
Line 25 in the bill,
you know,
page 28.
I don't know when you live in the house or not, but one day somebody said, I'm going to vote for this bill, but if only St. John's doesn't sit down, I'll tell people no. I think I talk about me the same way.
I think you're judging this, Keith, in terms of the totality of whether probable cause exists.
I'd say that he knows that a crime has been committed, and the only thing he knows with respect to who did it was an anonymous phone call. That would be enough.
No, probably wouldn't be enough, because the information from the informant would have to be taken into account in the totality of the circumstance. In other words, if he knew out at this house that there was, I remember a place out by the Portland Airport that was used, an old abandoned house that was used as cutting grounds for drugs, and the police knew that it was. Now, if he had that prior information, and then he received a telephone call from an informant, which a lot of police do, saying, tonight at 7:30 they're going to cut up another delivery out there, that, with the prior information, might rise it to the dignity of creating probable cause within the totality of all the circumstances. I know lots of police officers that have had informants who are reliable informants who they've never seen face to face, and you do too, probably.
Well, but they could identify them by
they
voice, by writing,
voice.
Or something.
Okay.
With prior history.
All right, but maybe the phone call alone is not enough. But I think the first sentence here, in determining whether probable cause exists to justify an arrest, I think that's what modifies the whole thing.
Well, also it goes on to say, and from an informant whom it is reasonable under the circumstances to credit. That further limits it. Right, to the kind of illustration you gave. I don't think it means, and I don't think that would rise to the dignity of probable cause to make an arrest, that you merely get an anonymous phone call. It's Joe Doe has committed a crime. I don't think that would meet the test for probable cause.
Sorry. I think that addition under the circumstances is reasonable to credit. I think that's an additional restraint.
Well, let's turn to page 31 of the bill. In subsection 6, there was a
page
criticism.
31.
Page 31 of the bill, subsection 6, there was a comment made after convicted on line 16 that if the person were not convicted or some problem in how to get rid of the goods or vehicle or conveyance or whatever it is. Don, do you see what's meant?
Well, I suppose they're, what they're driving at is that this provides guidelines for forfeiture after conviction, but it doesn't say what they do with the property after an acquittal. The only thing I could see from that. Is that in these written?
No, I've got it written in my book.
What page on your book?
Page 67, subsection 6. Somebody said something about the word convicted in the third line, that if they weren't convicted, how was the sheriff to get rid of the conveyance? See any problem, Don?
Can I get it pursuant to 142.090 and set forth in sub 4?
Sub 4.
Subsection 4 is meant to require some strong showing at the outset before the vehicle can be held. Sub 6 is after the court has already determined that the vehicle should be held, and then you go ahead with your trial. I certainly would concede that you got a different standard here as far as the burden of proof is concerned. One's reasonable doubt for conviction. I assume they do what they're doing now. If you don't have a conviction, then you return the conveyance or the vehicle. I don't have any quarrel with some proposed amendment if there's some question as to the some ambiguity here, though.
Senator Ivers moves the adoption of Article 4. Discussion.
I have a note on the book on page 64, section 116. And that is about this, what do you call it, citizen's arrest.
Yeah, they had the comment that it should be combined, 114 and 116 should be combined, but I think they're all right. Don't you, Don?
I think they could be combined again, but I don't see there's any problem. I noticed I had a note after over in the margin. I don't know who raised this. Subsection 1 was unnecessary.
Yeah,
maybe that was part of the same recommendation. You don't need sub 1 because the officer would do that anyway. Be required to do that anyway.
You're saying we don't need it?
Well, I'm not saying
sub 1 of 116.
And I, this may have been part of the same recommendation that sub 1 wasn't necessary and sub 2 could be combined with sub 114. We're talking about arrest by
so
private person. Either way.
I move that the sub 1 be deleted and that sub 2 be worked in by Don to 114 and the sections be renumbered.
I have another.
In just a minute.
Are you in the book or in the?
No, he's in the book.
In the book.
Too hasty.
That old cabinet.
Now you got one, Dick. Are you gonna lit well enough alone?
What time is it?
What section of the book?
Time to go.
What section of the book?
It's section 114 of the book.
Procedures Act. Arrest by a private person.
Mm-hmm.
And you want to combine that with what?
116.
Take sub 2 of 116 and work it into 114. And shall we say, just eliminate sub 1 of 116.
Well, 116 isn't even in the bill.
Right.
You have to
right.
Okay. That's the local government too. I got to
listen. I'm not going to vote in local government to introduce any criminal law bills.
All right, John, you too.
I'll just move to.
I think it's a matter of policy if it's another section.
Add to section 74 that the person making a private arrest shall. Take the person before magistrate and repeal 133.560.
Correct.
Right. All those in favor of the amendment say aye.
Aye.
Now, does this mean
opposed?
That he can't get a police officer to help him out? If he takes him to the police officer, he has to take care of the magistrate?
No.
No, it doesn't mean that.
He still can take him to a policeman, though.
Yeah.
It says that someplace.
Right.
I have a note on page 66 of the yellow book. And my question was, and I believe it's been discussed, I missed it, but what about a joint ownership on section 125? Is this taken care of?
That is a real problem.
Sorry,
it really
up.
Is. But
would you rather I just skip it?
Yeah.
Okay, I'll skip it.
All right, Senator Ivers has moved.
We haven't discussed section 73. I don't understand why a magistrate orders any person to arrest somebody. Why doesn't he need to call a cop and arrest him himself?
For the offense committed in his presence?
73.
Well, not as much.
Page 28, line 32.
And the person in contempt of court, they don't arrest the person.
Well, since it does authorize a verbal order of arrest by the magistrate, I suppose that the any person language is to whoever happens to be handy in the courtroom, the judge wants to use him as an arm of the court to physically effect the arrest of this individual.
The magistrate doesn't have the authority to make an arrest, does he?
Sure.
He can order one, but he can't make it himself, other than
like
a private person.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can do that way.
That's right. He wouldn't have any authority to arrest other than
a private
citizen,
person.
Except as in his authority to order the arrest as a magistrate. I think that's correct.
Does that answer your question?
Well, why did you say command any peace officer to arrest?
I don't care what.
Come on, we can't be like that.
I'm all with you, Mr. Chairman. I move we adopt.
All right. Senator Ivers moves we adopt Article 4. Discussion. Clerk,
yeah.
Call the roll.
Senator John Boone. Senator Keith Boone.
No.
Senator Ivers.
Aye.
Senator Boyce.
Aye. I don't know if
Senator Smith.
I don't even have the red line, but I got it marked right in.
Aye. All right. search and seizure. I don't want to make a futile exercise in going through it. One opinion has been expressed to me that it should be excised from the bill. Do you want to consider the article, not tonight, before you decide whether or not you want to consider it in a separate bill or leave it in?
Let's try it on a motion.
What's your motion?
Move it. Search and seizure be excised and be placed in another bill and be introduced as a committee bill.
Alright, Senator Smith moves that Article 5, search and seizure, be excised from Senate Bill 80 and be drafted as a bill by the Judiciary Committee and so entered. Clerk, call.
Can we get a discussion on this?
The wheels of progress are moving.
Without being held in contempt, Senator, if I could just raise this point. the article on search and seizure has, as you well know, other things besides the controversial parts dealing with the warrantless searches. And that is where I think the lines are drawn on the policy question of whether we should attempt to codify the area of warrantless searches. I would hate to see the provisions relating to search warrants and the other procedural improvements that are proposed here, on which there is very little, if any, disagreement, go down the chute along with the warrantless searches, whether it's in a separate bill or not.
Well, did the motion comprehend only the warrantless search part?
No, it said Article 5, search and seizure.
Motion could be amended, though.
You could consider that aspect of the thing so that, in other words, beginning with Section 91 of the bill, and going through, through Section 104
for the bill.
Yes, and then of course now inspectorial searches is
94.
That's a different consideration, and I think there's some controversy there, but for different reasons, and because we're talking about procedural searches and the mechanism for having an inspectorial search.
Oh, where's the warrantless search?
Okay, well, the warrantless search begins with section 91 and goes up through section 104.
And then the inspectorial searches.
The rest of it deals with inspectorial searches or disposition of things seized, which begins at section 108.
108 is inspectorial searches. What's your motion, Bob?
Okay, my motion is, Madam Chairman, to excise sections 83 through 91.
Are you in the book?
No, in the bill.
No, 83 is the issue of the warrant.
Well, that's
91 is where it starts.
Oh, it starts 91.
On page 38.
Yeah, okay. 91 to 104. And let's see, inspectorial goes from 104, does it?
Yes.
108.
108. All right. 108.
The motion that is to excise 91 to 108 in place of 108.
Senator Smith moves to excise sections 91 through 108 from Senate Bill 80 and to put and for the committee to have them drafted into a separate bill and introduced by the committee. Discussion.
Well, it seems to me like we ought to make up our minds whether we're going to have confidence in the work of this commission or not have it, and judge it on its own merits and not the whole package, because I'm sure they put all this in context. I have a balanced bill here, and I hate to see it pulled out of the side in certain parts.
Let me speak to that, Keith, because when the vote was taken on this section in the morning, one of the members of the commission was absent, and his presence there would have changed would have changed whether this was in or out. And I'm not exactly sure that there was a... I think it's safe to say that there was less of a consensus by the commission on this particular area than anything else that we did over the last 6 years. That fair to say, Don?
Yes, that probably was about as close on gun control, I think.
You did make that in a separate bill.
That was also, as far as the closeness of the vote, yes, I think those two areas, gun control and warrantless searches, would be pretty close.
Further discussion?
Well, then I think this way we're going to treat it. I think on each section we ought to know what the vote of the commission was, because I think we ought to be able to get the, have the commission. I've been given the same weight on each one. Is that much different from what's representing the commissioner?
Well, I think we ought to know it.
You favor the warrantless search provision?
I want to codify it, yes.
Further discussion?
Well, I'm going to explain my vote first. For a vote, I'm with Keith. I would support Article 5 in these parts that are under criticism here, but I certainly don't want to jeopardize the work of the whole enterprise. And if it's a close vote committee, why, that would probably indicate some idea of what's going to happen on the floor. But I'd like to go ahead with the vote and see. We can always change our vote.
And I want to explain something else that's meaningful to you. While I have voted to get some things here and so forth already, that doesn't mean that that I'm opposed to this bill. It doesn't mean that I can't support it. I mean, there are things I'd like to do to correct it, but there's nothing that's happened so far that has meant that much to me.
Further discussion.
Well, I just want to say this. There's been some unfortunate rhetoric that's surrounded this particular article. There have been some who are friends of law enforcement who have said let's not codify this because the Berger Court is going to be more conservative than the Warren Court, and if we codify the Warren Court decisions, we get locked into them in the statute, and our objective is to liberalize, or is to tighten up the Warren Court decisions. Now, I have the support, as a matter of philosophy, the decisions of the Warren Court with respect to most of these things. I have a serious reservation in my mind with respect to procedure, to codifying Supreme Court decisions. Now, we did it on the Miranda warning in the warning business, but I'm not sure that it's appropriate here. I've said that before.
I mean, well, I agree with your philosophy that I believe it should be codified, and the reason is I think the police officers are at a greater disadvantage knowing what the hell they should do out there, and I don't think district attorneys or anybody else do a very good job. Well, I'll take that back. I don't think the job they do is very meaningful to police officers in trying to show the ifs, ands, or buts about Supreme Court decisions, and I think they ought to have it in front of them, be able to read it, and know what to do in each and every case. I think it would be very helpful in that direction, and if people think that that's kowtowing to criminals or something like that, it's that indecisiveness of the police officers, and it's not their fault, that causes so many guilty people to be released. They screw up cases by not knowing what they should do. It's a more expensive thing by not having it codified.
I think everybody's too tired to decide. It means a job.
Boy, just raise a boat when you're about to come. Who knows who will ring my arm during the evening. The text meeting.